I guess we're recording. Okay, here we go.
We built up empires. We stole countries. That's what you do. That's how you build an empire. We stole countries with the cunning use of flags. Yeah. You just sail around the world and stick a flag in. I claim India for Britain. And they go, you can't claim us. We live here. 500 million of us. Do you have a flag? We don't need a bloody flag. It's our country, you bastard. No flag, no country. You can't have one. That's the rules that I've just made up. And I'm backing it up with this gun that was lent from the National Rifle Association. That was it, you know.
All right, everybody. We're here, and we're on audio, and we all jumped on. This is already a better format. Brass, I just want to make sure everybody say something, for God's sake. I want to make sure the audio is working.
Hello, welcome
Hello.
To Happy
okay.
Hour 3 Hour.
So our today's show, new format, new things happening, dip-a-dip-a-dim. And today's show is explorers, which I think is an awesome like subject matter. But Dan, you and your fedora in this exotic locale, you wanna tell us where you're at?
Yeah, I'm in. I'm not in Chicago. I am in Trinidad, Colorado, until November for the election.
Dang! All right,
eating some awesome green chili food. It's fantastic. Green chili food. Okay.
So
Explorers is the name of the game today. I'm super excited about the subject matter because I have somebody that's going to join us in just a second here that has made exploration and their this whole idea of like kind of the Indy Jones dynamic. And like the Jules Verne notion of exploration has really been impactful in their lives. They work for an organization that makes the outdoors accessible to people of color. So this whole notion of I think Brass just figured out who it might be. I personally have a fondness and an attachment to this person. I think Dan, you might too. In fact, I think we all might because it's my brother, Chris.
Hey. Look at that.
Awesome. Hey.
So nice.
Christian, let's just start by everybody. Let's take a moment to describe Christian's household and we see in the background. Like I think that there's an Aztec thing in the background and there's dinosaurs and, mm-hmm. and there's all sorts of things. Christian, you've taken this whole exploration aesthetic to heart. You've made it part of your career. What are you drinking there?
Oh yeah, please share.
Explorers Club iced tea.
Ooh, I see. So you're drinking out of an Explorers Club mug. What an interesting coincidence, because I too am drinking an Explorers Club mug. And this is my Explorers Club hat. But Christian, you have an Explorers Club flag back there, which I believe is a rarity. And I don't know how you got it, but by gum, that's
nice.
Tell us a little bit about the Explorers flag, Explorers Club flag, Christian. What's the significance of that?
So the Explorers Club flag has been up at the top of Everest. It's been at the bottom of the ocean inside a submarine. It's been to the moon. If you're an explorer, club fellow or member and you have an expedition, you take the flag with you. And though it has been replicated and imitated often, including by the Royal Geographic Society or some little club like that, the Explorers Club flag is the one that you'll see everywhere. So when you see that, you're like, that's official now.
There you go. So now we know. And so we know that, and believe me, I've been inside Christian's apartment. So I can tell you that placing the Explorers Club flag in there was a dangerous feat because he had a cat. Anyway, so I wanted to start this conversation before we dive into it. And we've got a bunch of explorers we're going to be talking to. And I do want to keep like each of them brief. We're just going to kind of give everybody a super top level. But we started the whole episode with this idea of, by the way, Christian, full name there. You can turn it into Christian or Explorer Christian.
Oh, I love it.
Just so you guys know, Christian works with Latino Outdoors, which is the organization that I was talking about. So we started with that Eddie Izzard clip about, do you have a flag? And also, you know, like it's not just, like the idea of flag my land is also like part of the Spanish conquista and the French, wherever they went. Just all of these European explorers during the age of exploration had this whole conquest kind of vibe to it. And what I think is interesting is like literally none of us chose as our explorers, anyone from the age of exploration. None of us chose Vasco da Gama. None of us said like Marco Polo. None of us did, you know, Pizarro. None of us did Hernan Cortez. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that, because the question is like how much of it was exploration and how much of it was expansion. And I do feel like there's a big difference. And Dan, you kind of ran at 100 miles an hour into that argument of expansion versus exploration with the first team that we're going to be talking about, of explorers that we're going to be talking about. But, you know, I kind of wanted everyone to just kind of like, why didn't you guys choose Hernan Cortez or Christopher Columbus or Amerigo Vespucci or any of those guys?
Are you asking
Dan? Any of you guys?
Oh,
enough's been said. Well,
enough's been said.
Well, I can't make it more pithy than that. Well, okay. My approach was, oh, this is going to be a very, I love this topic, but we've got nothing but, you know, white guys telling us what to do. And I thought, well, I'll just go in a direction where women started stepping out and adventuring on their own.
Yeah.
But Isabella Bird is Scottish.
Right. And a lot
of field. So I'm sliding into that. Yeah, we kind of
very eurocentric, like exploration, yeah. And the whole notion of like romantic exploration, like it's always the great white hunter, right? Like there's always like there's a certain amount of whiteness, because what are we discovering? We're discovering indigenous lands that other people are there, right? Like what is discovery? And I think part of the reason I wanted Christian in on this conversation is because Christian has given this some thought. And Christian, not to put you in Christian Explorer, very nice. Not to put you on the spot here, but what does exploration mean when it's taken out of the context of when it's taken out of the context of like a Eurocentric, like, oh look, I've discovered these indigenous people kind of thing. Like, what is exploration?
So exploration at its core was originally essentially a call and response. It was people who would go from the village, and they were essentially scouts. And while the village would maintain its herds, its housing, the scouts would go to the top of the hill and they would shout to each other. And they would essentially they were exploring. And they were letting the hunters know, like, okay, here's a hill. There are things on the other side of the hill. So that is where exploration first started. It was a hillside to hillside, kind of like, hello, kind of thing. Then exploration, you know, and the idea that, like, that exploration is Western, like, I think exploration was just marketed by Westerners, but every single culture has had explorations. The wayfinders of Polynesia, the what's his name, Zheng He, the Chinese explorer,
basically made it to the Americas and then was just like, yeah, I'm good, right? Right.
But we never give him credit for getting here, or the Vikings.
Right. Or there was Bungari that I was reading about, the Aboriginal.
Right. We talked about Bungari, you guys remember? During our Australian thing, we talked about Bungari, yeah.
So it's all these that have been there and been doing it. Or it's just a part of the culture, but it's never been given that, like, that Explorers Club branding.
Right.
You know?
Branding. I mean, you've got the flag, I got the hat, we both got mugs. It's all branding. Like, it's very romantic.
Right. And so even though this stuff has been going on for centuries, millennia, I think social media, digital media is a really strong way of democratizing quote unquote exploration so that anybody can brand themselves. And these kinds of techniques, like you think about Fawcett, Percy Fawcett, you think about the atrocities.
So Percy Fawcett, just to remind our viewers,
we have never had a timeout called in the show. Wow.
Here we go.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
You guys remember last week?
Yes.
I brought this book out as the preview for this week. So Christian's referencing this guy's dad. So what about Percy Fawcett, Christian?
So Percy Fawcett did something that is very similar. We look nowadays and we're like, oh, yeah, that's called a podcast. Or, oh, yeah, that's an episode of this. But what Percy Fawcett did was he serialized his adventures, his exploration. And it was literally by the skin of his teeth. Every week he was like, sponsors, anybody, I promise that I'm going to have this special guest next week. I don't know how in the world I'm going to do it.
This is the Percy Fawcett who was from Lost City of Z, or is this his child?
No, this is Lost City of Z, and he carried in telegraph, radio equipment into the jungle. While people were dying, they were still getting the dispatches back. Got so it. They could keep readership up so that the sponsorships could keep coming in so that they could get food sent to them by the next depot.
Wow.
Much like podcasting today.
Yeah, but like...
Yes, and by the way, Explorers Club or anybody listening out there to this specific episode, we are open for sponsorships. And don't forget, Anchor is also our sponsorship. If you want to create a podcast like this one and have it up on Spotify, Anchor. All right, that's at least 50 cents right there. okay, so with all of that in mind... there is that notion of exploration versus conquest / expansion, and no two people sort of represent that, like, that thing better than these two fellows, right? And so, Dan, who are these guys? Dan?
Oh, Dan.
We're looking for you to say something.
Could you guys hear me?
Yeah,
oh, there you are. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
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 Okay. All right. Yeah. Lewis and Clark. That's my first set of explorers. Right. So yes. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. The background. So they were sent out by Thomas Jefferson, who bought a bunch of land sight unseen. What they were looking for really was a way to get to the Pacific Ocean, right? So one of the biggest things that European explorers were looking for was a way across the Americas to get to the Pacific Ocean. So they're essentially still looking for that elusive Northwest Passage, which they didn't really find.
Well, it didn't exist.
It doesn't really exist unless you have like an icebreaker.
Right? Oh, it exists now because of global warming.
Right. But it doesn't in a natural setting.
Right.
But so they were the core of discovery. Was the group that it was with. And what I like about the William and Clark adventure is it was sort of the moonshot of the early 19th century, right? Like, are they going to make it? Are they going to live? Right? and do we have the technology to do this? So they set out, right, from Independence up the Missouri River, up into Montana, over the Bitterroot Mountains and all of this, down the Snake River, onto the Columbia River, out to the Pacific Ocean, which essentially where Astoria, Oregon is today, and lived out there, and then made it all the way back to St. Louis. Only one person died, and he died of like smallpox very early. Everyone else made it back. The dog that they took with them made it back.
Oh, that's good news.
So,
what was the dog's name?
Very, I don't know. What is the dog's name?
The most important detail of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and you can't just produce it immediately, Dan. Come on.
So the lunar expedition, right? Super important in the for lack of a better word, United States. But they weren't alone. There were a lot of government expeditions that went out. Stephen Long for Long's Peak.
Oh, okay.
Zebulon Pike.
Zebulon Pike.
They all set out in different directions, going north, straight across, and then to the south. Sort of, you know, it was like the NASA of its day. What's that?
It was called the Corps of Exploration or the Exploration Corps. Is that it?
The Corps of Discovery was the that was specifically the Lewis and Clark expedition was the Corps of Discovery. But it ended sadly.
Oh, how did it? Why did it end sadly? What happened?
Well, Lewis was a depressive, and may or may not have killed himself, may have been murdered. They found him with a head wound and a heart wound.
Oh, so he either pulled one of these or somebody shot him and then somebody shot him again?
Mystery.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of people are like,
I did not know that.
Well, he was robbed, but...
Mm. So I wanted to show two pictures of the Lewis and Clark expedition that I think like kind of summarize what the Lewis and Clark expedition might be in like popular culture. So we have this image here, and this image is the Lewis and Clark expedition celebrating the first 4th of July west of the Mississippi. And I think this is very like telling, you know, like you've got your fancy clothes, you got your feathers in your hat, you got your flags, and everybody's drinking beer, celebrating, you know, it's literally the notion of the Eddie Izzard thing of like, do you have a flag, right? And here it is, the Lewis and Clark expedition with this menacing looking little gun, deck gun here on the boat. I think that's an interesting image of the Corps of Expedition. And I think that one is a little bit more foreign to us because what we really think about when we think about Lewis and Clark is this, right? And there's Sacagawea. Right. They're dressed in leather at this point. Like the dress is a lot more indigenous. and practical, right? Like there's fewer feathers and epaulets, and so I think that this is something that happens. Like this is a good way of like sort of separating like I feel like literally every explorer that actually ends up exploring ends up taking on these indigenous guides and also like traditions in order to actually exist in the space that they are intruding on. And I think that like the story of Sacagawea and the fact that Lewis and Clark couldn't do it without an actual indigenous scout, I think is important to the whole notion of exploration, because the indigenous scouts are often forgotten. And yet they are key to the entire thing. And I think like one [S2] Right. [S1] Of my favorite, I think the most famous, like we did it together kind of story is Mallory or Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. Is that it? Tenzing Norgay? Christian, you wanna tell us a little bit about Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay and like who was up Everest first?
Edmund Hillary was a kind of a scrawny beekeeper and essentially like he was number 23 in this expedition of like fitness, of rank, of all those things. And that's when expeditions were, you know, part military, part geographic society, part entrepreneurism, all of those things rolled into one. They still kind of are, but this was like the end of it, really. This was the subject of it. And it happened essentially, like, basically they were still in that limelight when Elizabeth was crowned. The beekeeper and the queen was the, you know, the last thing that England could hold on to. And so people got sick. They kept getting sick. Hillary was like, I'm not sick yet. I'm still alive. I'm still here. Tenzing, and it's always Tenzing Norgay Sherpa. And Sherpa is just the people of the Himalayas. So Tenzing was always there, just on top of it, dragging people, dragging equipment. Going up to advanced base camp, coming back down, and then the day happened that they said George Lowe was like, I can't do it. You're gonna have to do it, the two of you, and luckily they got along well enough. And so Tenzing went ahead. He really did, and Hillary made it up. And the picture is of Tenzing, the famous one that you see of somebody like at the top of Everest, but they've got moon gear on them, basically. Yeah. Moon gear and a sleeping bag like wrapped around them. Yeah. That's Tenzing in that picture. And so they came back down and it was kind of like, what are we gonna tell everybody? And they said, we did it together. That's the story. That's what it is. And Hillary was like, I did it. And they started making the rounds. And as they made the rounds, I think it became more difficult for Edmund Hillary to stick to that. And so one of these reoccurring things about explorers and taking credit is that when you look back, when we have the luxury of you know, StreamYard and Google and all these things, and we look back at all these heroes, quote unquote, which ones hold up?
Right.
And Edmund Hillary, to his credit, held up. He went back to the Himalayas, he established schools, every penny that he had went towards building hospitals. He lost his family, his wife and his kid and his daughter, on an airplane crash as they were coming in to teach at one of these schools. Like he left everything of himself in Nepal. And to his dying day, he everything like every year he would come back, all his money he would always send over there. Like that's how touched he was. That's not Edmund Hillary. So
because literally, like you see the British flag, it's 100% implied that that is in fact Edmund Hillary.
Right. And there they are, and they were contemporaries. And then so afterwards, you know, one of the big things, you're like, all right, we did it. We spent money. Now we've got to recoup money. What do we do? And they go on the circuit.
Got it. And the circuit is important for all of the explorers. And let's ask Dan, do you know if Clark went on a talking tour?
You know, I think they did.
I
think that there was sort of
books.
And their journals are still like high sellers. I don't know. They're not bestsellers, very high sellers today, unlike Amazon and stuff like that. It's fascinating.
They brought kind of Sacagawea along, right? Like it was the whole show of the exploration, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, right. So, I mean, well, and let's be honest, I mean, you were talking about it got a little crackly there for a second, but that expedition was a success because of her, and not just her, there were plenty of other native people that helped them along. She just happened to be the famous one because of her story with the baby on her back the whole way, right? I think it's a great story. I really like it. I looked up the dog. His name was Seaman.
Newfoundland.
Wait, what was his name?
Seaman.
Ah, okay. Got it. Okay.
Not Sailor. Seaman. So one of the tensest moments on the entire trip is a group of native people stole the dog. And I guess Clark was just like, nobody's leaving until we get the dog back.
Yeah, this sounds like a famous movie. We're not leaving till the dog comes
but
back.
But they get the dog back. But it was one of the tensest moments. It was one of the few times that like diplomacy almost went away, became a little.
Yeah, they're just like, we're going to shoot all of you.
Where's the dog?
They all went down with the whole thing. Huh?
Where that dog at?
Yeah. All right. So I think this is actually like a good like segue at the idea of Western expansion. And Dan, you are just like, you are all about the discovery of the American West. But I think people don't really understand we feel because the American West was populated from both sides, there was kind of like a crunch into the middle. Just how unknown the geography was in the middle of the continent for how long. So Dan, you wanted to talk about John Wesley Powell. And there is John Wesley Powell.
Wow.
Tell us all about it.
So George Wesley Powell here, Civil War veteran, apparently had a terrible personality.
Oh, no kidding.
It's also cut out a little questionable on how he kept his group. There were probably more. His group of explorers that went with him down the Colorado River, he was the first person to go Colorado River, first European white guy to go down the Colorado River, basically from its starting point in Colorado to the Gulf of California, really. You know, Shot Rapids in the Grand Canyon and all of that in wooden boats, by the way. Oof. He had one arm. You can see it, one there.
Oh, I thought he was just embracing his friend there. It's not there.
No, he's leaning up there.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And he
one arm.
He was strapped into the boats. He was strapped into the boats so he wouldn't fly out.
This is very like
so let's just take a moment here to also acknowledge that there is to all of these explorers, and we will get right like you said, Lewis was a depressive. This guy had one arm and strapped himself into. There is a little insanity to. There's a little madness to exploration. And I think you know, there, especially during this period, like there's just, these guys were eccentrics. You know, the beekeeper, I dare say, was an eccentric. What is a beekeeper doing in the Himalayas, or Himalayas if you're British, right? What are these people doing in these places? You kind of have to be a little bit nuts. And this guy, I dare say, looks nuts.
Yeah. He looks like he would pick a fight with anybody, even with one arm.
Right. And so more on Powell is important. Yeah, his adventures are fascinating reads. But really important is he mapped these and went down these rivers in the American West. And he really is the one that was like, right? So river, that's Grand Lake. It's Colorado River. Up the start, you see Estes Park. He also did the South Platte, the North Platte, all of this. He was very familiar with these rivers, and he wrote a report and said, that's going to be a real tough area to settle because of the water situation. He advocated that the states should be around the rivers, not big rectangles like we have. And Congress was like, thanks, that's a bit depressing. We're going to do it this way, which is why we have it the way it is. He basically said,
Wyoming are both
it's
giant.
Too humid, it's too dry. And,
fridge
and
box.
That's why, you know, we're facing some of the environmental problems that we have today because we really didn't follow
Powell's
advice.
Yeah. All right. So, John Wesley Powell, any other interesting anecdotes? I'm trying to keep this kind of moving. So anything else you want to add about John Wesley Powell that might be of interest other than the fact that he had one arm, he was a river person, and he'd like to strap himself into wooden boats and hurl himself down the Grand Canyon?
What else needs to be said?
I couldn't agree more.
I want to fill in the blanks on my own time now.
Right? Yeah. Well,
I want to look at it by myself.
Like, I think the reason we're doing this is because they're all a little crazy and it just appeals. You're just like, man, these guys were nuts.
Okay. There's my girl. Now I just want to say I grew up on a tributary of the South Platte. It was in my backyard. So I was one of those little river kids that my dad just one day said, hey, you know what? We should sail down this river. We should go down the Platte. Well, let's go. So we tied two blow up rafts, you know, those just little inflatable rafts. We tied two of them together. We drove up to Milliken. We put the rafts in the water and my dad made an oar and we just floated down the Platte and looked at the birds and looked at the tadpoles and showed up right in our backyard, pulled everything out, went in the house.
Wow.
That's amazing. It's an amazing little mini adventure. And we had to get up and carry it because the river was so low. You know, the Platte gets real low sometimes.
Yeah.
We had to carry the boat and then put it back in the water, and then we were sailing again. I recommend anybody do it. It's a great childhood experience.
You can tell by Christian's face that he knows I'm about to expose him for adventuring on in a drainage ditch in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
But yeah, but basically the same deal, right? Like I think that idea of strapping yourself into something that floats and sailing down and see where it takes you, especially for landlocked kids like us, right? Like we were in Colorado, there's no ocean. Call to the river and to the water, it's strong. All right, let's talk about your lady.
All right. We got a wee Scottish lass right now. Her name is Isabella Bird. Isabella Bird was not even 5 foot tall. She came from some moderate wealth. She's wealthy enough to have a doctor prescribe her travel for her health.
Is there no greater indicator of wealth than the prescription of travel? Good grief.
That was her lot in life. They said they had a cute little phrase for her. They said she was an invalid at home, but a Samson abroad.
Ah.
So when she traveled, by God, her health improved, her breathing improved, her skin condition improved. She was a monster on the road, but the second you brought her home to Scotland, she couldn't get out of bed.
And I get that. I feel like you know, yeah. this is an illustration of her, by the way. And she's a Victorian, right?
Well, yeah, you could say she's born in 1831.
Victorian.
Yeah. 1831, and she made it for pretty near 70 years, which, considering she had chronic health issues, 70 years old is a pretty impressive length of time to be on Earth. But let's talk about why I chose her specifically.
Yeah,
I have a secret reason, but I'm going to reveal that as I tell you where she's traveled.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty exciting that this woman, though not a part of an explorer club and not destined or hired to do any of this travel, she traveled for the pure love of it. And her family said, you know what? You're such a good letter writer. You write us such incredible, rich stories about what you're seeing. Have you ever thought about going pro with it? So she did turn into a exploration author. She became a published author of the places she's been, but this was one of the first women, just a woman, going to Asia, Singapore, Vietnam, Korea, China, Japan, Malaya. She went to India when she was 60 years old. Like, at 60, she's like, yeah, today we're going to India. Like, it's incredible how daring she was. She went through Persia. She went through Turkey. She was in Kurdistan. She was at the borders of Tibet. She was in Baghdad. She was in Tehran. Like, she was the first woman allowed to the Royal Geographical Society, the first woman.
Oh, she was. Oh, that's amazing. And, you know, and I think for a little perspective, most men in this period of time would do something called the Grand Tour, which they would pack up in a, sort of an in-between year after university or before university.
Yeah.
And they'd go to exotic locales such as Rome and Spain, right? Yeah. And they're like, oh, I'm living like a savage here, right? Yeah. Like, it's just like, oh, the Spanish with their guitars, it's so exotic.
Yeah.
And this woman, exactly, dabbing and the Bosphorus, you know, these and here you have a woman going to Vietnam during this era, and that is way out there. She went to Korea as well.
Yeah.
I think is super interesting.
Started in Japan.
I didn't think
Japan let people in. I thought Japan was a closed door. She got into Japan.
And I think that's like it's pretty amazing. I was watching a thing on Jack London, speaking of explorers, good California guy, explorers. But Jack London was one of the first Americans to kind of actually get out to Korea and see it and report back on it. And this lady had already been there by the time Jack London got out there.
Right.
So I think there's a lot to be said about like what an amazing groundbreaker she was. This picture that you sent me, I was interested in. What's going on here?
This is the reason why I was like, oh, I was destined to talk about her. Oh boy. So we've got her doing a beautiful world tour of the Far East, the Near East. She comes through and she lands in Hawaii. She's given a special accommodation in Hawaii. She climbs the highest volcano in Hawaii, this little old lady.
Uh-huh.
From Hawaii, she ends up in Colorado.
Get out.
She stayed in Colorado for a long time, guys. Because this gentleman here, well, it may not be that gentleman, but he fell in love with a one-eyed mountain man named, I shit you not, guys. I shit you not. He's a one-eyed mountain man in Colorado, and they called him Rocky Mountain Jim.
Oh, wow.
Rocky Mountain Jim.
And Jim's last name is Nugent. I'm just saying there could be a relation there. They didn't get pregnant or anything. They never got married. She said he's a man that any woman would love, but no sane woman would marry.
Much like Dan, and yet there we are.
Right. So she comes from home from Colorado. I mean, she was there a long time. She did not want to leave. I think she was having a real good time with Rocky Mountain Jim. But yeah, she comes home. She did eventually pass away in 1904. You know, there was tons of disease in the world at that time, but she managed to sluice through the entire globe without catching a major illness. But and a lot of the native populations hated the idea of her being there, and they tried to scare her out. So they were, you know, running after her and chasing her and trying to frighten her away, but she maintained the course. Let me see if I can remember how it was that she passed. I just think it's incredible for a little tiny, less than 5 foot tall woman to get out here and just absolutely dominate the field the way she did and saw everything she wanted to see. She returned from a trip in Morocco and fell ill and died in her home at Edinburgh, 1904, Dean Cemetery. Well, it doesn't really say what killed her, but she fell ill and died. That's all they want to say about it.
A gunshot to the head and the heart.
No, yeah, nothing. Wow, yeah. No,
choking, burning, and drowning all at once.
Oh, right. Okay. She came from the Yangtze and Han River, then Morocco, and then home, and then died. So she really had a great.
This is you can tell by the dress and the clothes here, and the braid here that she is in fact in China, in this picture. And I don't know if that's her camera equipment or if that's somebody else's. It alludes.
She brought the camera equipment with her. She had somebody help her carry all that. So it's bigger than her. She had somebody, even though she was like an infirm person, a small lady, she also brought along tons of luggage for camera equipment for actual exploration. Like she was measuring things. She was really taking it seriously and then writing these amazing poetic letters and stories that turned into a publication about what she had seen. She had a real connection with language.
Amazing. She's a great lady, and I never knew anything about her. Christian, did you know about her?
I all I knew is that she was the first fellow of the Royal Geographic, the first woman fellow of the Royal Geographic.
And now you know how she earned it. And now we know about Rocky Mountain Jim. I was like, oh my God, I know I am Scottish. I'm a little Scottish, and I know that, but I was like, God, if I find out I'm related to this woman, this shit would happen to me too. I've had some Rocky Mountain Jims in my life, my God. Here's Isabella Slanche.
All right, so it's now my turn for this kind of age of exploration sort of thing. And for me, I've always had a deep love for Arctic exploration. When I was a kid, one of the first books that I read and one of the first books that I had as a kid was a book on Roald Amundsen, who was a Norwegian Arctic explorer. And since then, there's just always been a thing. You know, when you're a kid and you're exposed to something and you're just like, trigger, right? Like, you're just like, holy smokes, this is the thing. And what's amazing is I must have been in first grade when I read the book about Roald Amundsen. And then I think I was in fifth grade when they discovered the bodies of the Amundsen exploration. So like literally, like I had been exposed to this thing and they discovered it and I saw it in the newspaper. And so Arctic exploration has always held a fascinating spot in my heart for me. And so I think one of the most chaotic, historically dopey, messy expeditions in the history of expeditions is a U.S. expedition to the North Pole. Was it the North Pole? Yes, North Pole. And it is, of course, the Robert Peary expedition to the North Pole. I think to describe it as a shit show is doing a disservice to shit shows. Christian, am I wrong in this take?
No. Most expeditions were like that.
most polar expeditions were shit shows. I'll agree with that. They're just like, all right, we have survival gear, we have chest sets, we have 15 crates of books, and we have lavender, and we're good. We're good to go, right? And you're just like, do you need the crates of lavender for this? I'm not entirely sure that making sure that you have the smell of lavender while you're in the like. It's always weird things like that when you look at like what they took with them, and inevitably, it's like, oh, our ship got stuck in the ice. What a surprise! Literally, every ship got stuck in the ice, and then it's just like, okay, well, now we're going to eat someone, and that's just like over and over and over. The Peary expedition did not eat anyone. I believe that is so. I guess in a certain way, it wasn't as much of a shit show. But considering how far ahead it was of other Arctic expeditions, it's a miracle they didn't eat anyone. So, and I don't want to give too much attention to Peary himself. The person I wanted to bring up in this is Matthew Henson. Yeah, exactly. Because the Peary was a nasty kind of racist show off. I think you get those sorts. He's basically Brass. He is the Aleister Crowley of Arctic exploration.
Me say no more. Right? It's like, we acknowledge you de facto, but you are not one of us. You are not the authentic thing, but yes, you were here once, so you count.
Right. So before I get into Matthew Henson, I do want to, Christian, anything you want to add to like the significance of the Peary expedition and why Peary himself is kind of like, ugh.
Well, I mean, other than
Treebeard.
What? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So other than the fact that Peary was not the first man to the North Pole, it was Henson, and then the Inuits Ukwa, Uta, Engiwa, and Siglu. And Peary, again, took all the credit. Henson wasn't allowed to be in the, he wasn't allowed to do the circuit with Peary. And it wasn't for several years later. And then there's this just beautiful picture of Matthew Henson in his 70s, you know, old, bald, glasses, and he's got this like smirk where he's finally given the awards, congressional recognition, a fellow at the Explorers Club, all these things. And it's this kind of like, cool, thanks, great, I'm 70. I discovered the North Pole. And then he had love children. Matthew Henson had love children with the Inuits, and he was not allowed to be buried in Arlington. And it wasn't until his children, the love children from the Inuits, that met up in New York in the 80s, that they were like, "Yo, let's talk about this." And they petitioned and they rattled some cages and they made some noise. And Robert Peary's grave is no longer just Robert Peary's grave, it's Peary and Henson at Arlington. Yep.
And so the truth is that an African-American explorer was in fact the first person to the North Pole along with Inuit guides. And it's funny that you, like, I'm not all that keen on the term love child, but the truth is, and I think that, like, Because very often this term love child is just like, yes, they walked in and raped someone and then got the person pregnant. That's very often the reality with exploration and explorers. Captain Cook being a perfect example of somebody who really enjoyed doing that. But Inuit culture is a little bit more free with sexual relations. And sexual relations as a form of affection is actually relatively common. And it is, I think, safe to say that the idea of a love child and that there was affection and that there was friendliness between these folks is actually accurate. So I would not say that's an incorrect assessment of it. I do want to point like this incredible photo where all the faces are darkened or blacked out, basically. Like, there, you can't see the faces very well here. I think that could potentially be on purpose. Here's another picture of the actual folks being first at the North Pole. As you can see, not a, a white face among them.
But do you have a flag?
Do you have a flag? And yes, there it is, the American flag right there on the North Pole. And the story of Matthew Henson, it is a story of redemption. And I believe this is at the Explorers Club, actually. This picture right here. Sorry?
Is that Truman? Who is that?
I don't know. Explorers Club.
Okay.
But yeah, this is the picture you were referring to, Christian, where he's old, he's bald, he's got all of these, but he's finally getting his due. And I think it's, you know, like the fact that the first man at the North Pole was an African American, a black man, and we didn't acknowledge it, like, just speaks to, like, it is one of those quintessential achievements of mankind. First to the pole, the race to the pole was something, it was a multinational race. People were dumping resources into it. I think the UK killed like 50% of its male population between the year 1845 and 1847, trying to send people to the polls, right? They're just like, all right, this time we've got it. We've got teacups, and that will make the difference, right? And so, like, the fact that it was a black man who reached there first, and that Perry himself was instrumental in keeping that away from him, I think just speaks to the world of exploration and explorers and how closed off it was, but how slowly that world is being democratized. And we're expanding the idea of what exploration truly is. And I think one of the weird things about Matthew Henson, and not weird, but just like touching things about Matthew Henson is how humble he was, and like, you know, there was just a certain there's a certain, like, there's more of a scientist vibe to him than kind of the lunatics like the guy who strapped himself into the boats. What's his name, Dan?
Powell.
On Wesley, yeah. Powell,
yeah. And I think so.
So Matthew Henson was.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Matthew Henson was known as Matthew the Kind One, which gives you an idea of what maybe they called Perry.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I guess. What was his name?
The Kind One and Perry the Bastard.
Wow.
Yeah. Makes sense. I feel like there is a certain had to be a kinship for how Perry was treating indigenous folks, because notoriously so, right, Christian? That Perry was there's stories about how poorly he treated them and how he exploited those folks. Am I right?
In Lost City of Z, super quickly, David Grand, the author, talks about this fantastic thing. He calls it the labyrinth of race, that even the most progressive explorers of their era were still racist. In the corner of their minds, they would still make circles and go around in these edges and box themselves into the idea of superiority versus inferiority. And so even the greatest explorers that we can look back on, even the ones that got it right, that still hold up, had that grain of racism that felt that they were superior and they had to explain it to others. And Matthew Henson is the exact example of when you step aside, that's what happens. Real exploration, teamwork happens.
Amazing. Let that be a lesson to everybody.
All right, so. We went from the kind one who had that sort of idea of exploration and sort of the humble but like effective human being, and I think it's time to race all the way to the other side now, to one of my favorite explorers and frankly, fashion inspo guy, and that is Peter Frusen. So oh. This is Steve. here's another picture of Peter. So 6'7".
Oh Lord.
6'7", Danish, 1900s explorer, wore a coat made of polar bear fur, rode a dog sled for 1,000 kilometers across the Greenland ice cap in the 1910s, killed a wolf with his bare hands, escaped Nazi death warrant at the height of the Third Reich, amputated his own gangrenous toes with a pair of pliers, no anesthesia, starred in an Oscar-winning movie, which was based on a book that he wrote, and he was the fifth person to win the jackpot on the $64,000 question. He found a club. Yeah, Peter Frusen.
That's a full life. Frusen.
I don't know exactly how to, but look at this guy. This is because he amputated his own leg.
Dude.
Yeah,
and he owns it.
Look at that. He owns it, right? Like that's. Like you can, his leg is in the dark over here because it's a peg leg.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, that's his wife. 6'7", that's his gigantic fur coat. I can't say enough about this wild man. I do think that one of the most important things, obviously Nazi killer, married 3 times.
This machine kills fascists.
Yes, this machine does kill fascists. He was born in Denmark in 1886, studied to be a doctor, basically signed on with every polar expedition he could, was just into the idea of getting out there and exploring and being just a general badass. He was married 3 times. First was married in 1911. 1911, he married Navarana Megkwepalik, an Inuit woman who died in the Spanish flu epidemic after marrying 2 children. And that's the thing. I think that's like just think about this. He was just like, this is my wife. This is my wife. And you can imagine like in the teens and 20s, like that wasn't necessarily the popular thing, but does he look like he gives a shit about what anybody might think here? Right? Like this is this guy. Okay. I'm gonna get to the most important part of Peter Frusen's in 1924 he married a millionaire who was an heiress, right? But he also, like, he took out his own tooth with anesthesia when he was trapped on ice. And then one of the most famous things is that he was he was buried in a snowstorm and had to dig himself out with an ice pick that he created out of, anyone?
Bone?
His own bone?
His own shit.
Like Stuart's bingo card. I did not expect.
I did not have that on my bingo card. Okay, so he a frozen little tool made of poo poo is what enabled him to dig himself out.
Yep.
I guess we can't knock it until we try it because he's alive, or he lived longer than he should have because he was able to do that.
Yeah, and so. He wrote in an autobiographical account in 1953 that he once shaped his excrement into the form of a chisel, waited for it to freeze, and then used it to escape from a pit of ice and snow.
Gosh. He just wouldn't accept no for an answer. He's like, I'm not going to die today. I'm not going to die today.
Not today.
I'm waiting for this chisel to freeze, and then I'm not going to die. Like, you have to be a little bit mad, Alf. You have to.
Yeah.
Because right? How else can you problem solve?
And
people would have accepted embarrassment of death.
And I mean, just look at him. Do you for a second doubt that this man would carve poop into a chisel and carve his way out of something? Absolutely. Yeah. No question. Absolutely no question. And then I think in addition to, and tip of the hat to this, does his wife look like she's impressed by it?
She's not bothered.
She is. Like, I think all of this is so spot on to what you would hope is his reality, which is to say he's hyper intense, kind of crazy, has done all of these wild things, and married the only woman who doesn't really think that that's all that impressive and loves him for who he is. And I think this picture is just unbelievable. And it really captures like a moment for them. I do want to say that during World War II, he was actively involved with the Danish resistance against occupation by Nazi Germany. Despite having lost a leg to frostbite, he openly claimed to be Jewish whenever he witnessed anti-Semitism. So you imagine this guy who's 6'7", he sees these Nazis bugging people, and he's like, I'm Jewish too, right? And just here's my shit axe, now what, right? Like this giant Thor in a polar bear coat is coming at you with an axe made of poop. I think it's it's pretty incredible. He openly claimed to be Jewish whenever he witnessed anti-Semitism. He was imprisoned by Germans and was sentenced to death, but he managed to escape and flee to Sweden. I don't know if he escaped with the help of any feces. And in 1945, he married a Danish Jewish designer, which is, I believe, this woman.
She has to be
this woman who he's pictured with in that thing. But he wrote a book called Vagrant Viking. And the whole thing is just absolutely amazing. They lived in New York, eventually had a second home in Connecticut, a bunch of books. There's actually video on YouTube of his appearance. I think that he, despite the fact that he actually didn't quite discover much, he was one of these people that lived for the thrill of exploration and experience and hugging closely to your bosom the idea of not giving a damn and seeing what's out there. So I love this guy deeply. This picture inspired me to buy a faux fur coat that is kind of similar to this. And the journey of me and my faux fur coat is one that I was having a difficult time finding something that might make me look like this and not like Liberace. Right. Difficult. Yeah. You lost hand. I wanted to give a shout out to the loony bird that was Peter Friesen. So Chris, go ahead.
I'd like to point out that a lot of, we talk about wild and insane explorers, mental health is true. They were not on the same lane as a lot of contemporaries, but they thrived and they did enormous things. And a lot of these explorers that we've covered are also disabled. And they were the very few of the types of people, especially in such prejudiced times, that were able to really show off those disabilities. And you know, like Lord Nelson, he just flipped up his shirt, pinned it. He's like, and what? This guy, you know, I'll wear a jacket over it. The other guy, I will figure out how to explore the river with it. So a lot of these explorers lived and thrived with their disabilities. I think that's worth mentioning.
I love that. Yeah, that's key to mention.
All right. So with that, I think Brass, you are
I'm
it's
perfect.
Sorry?
Am I bringing up the caboose here with our
You are bringing up the caboose. And I think space exploration is in many ways sort of the final frontier, despite the fact that I feel like also underwater exploration is one of those things.
Oh, yeah. The ocean.
And exploration and science and the natural world and all of those things. But really nothing captures like exploration in what we refer to as its most pristine sense as space exploration. And Bress, talk us through this, might I just say, beautiful young lady here.
It truly is something. This young lady is named May Carol Jemison, with an E, Jemison. May was born in 1956 in Alabama. So you can imagine what her future destiny could have been in the 50s in Alabama. Just next to nothing, you know?
But you know, Matthew Henson as well, child of sharecroppers.
Yeah.
Right? And like for people of color, specifically Black people, American Black people, African American folks, to reach these levels of exploration, the background is always the levels and the hoops that had to be jumped are always an adventure and an achievement in and of themselves. So yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in that, but I thought the Henson tie-in was relevant.
Super. I love that connection. It's super important that we always touch base with that. So yes. Her mom took a job up in Illinois, so she moved to Chicago and continued her primary and secondary education in Chicago. But she was one of those really smart kids that graduated high school early. And she got accepted into Stanford when she was 17. She got a medical degree.
It's a new kind of summer.
What happened?
But it's still summer.
Did something just happen?
Season.
Oh, I think a commercial showed up on my screen. Sorry. Commercial website. Sorry. So I closed that. So she earned a medical degree from Cornell. She was pursuing at Stanford a degree in chemical engineering and African American studies. So like you literally can't give this young woman enough to do. She can do it. After she graduated, she went to the Peace Corps in Liberia and Sierra Leone and was there until 1985, where she worked as a general practitioner. At that point, she decided she wanted to be an astronaut. A lot of the teachers that she told, like, I'm interested in space. I want to go in space. I want to be in space. They said, oh, I think you're confused. You want to be a nurse? And she goes, no, I mean astronaut space. And they're
what you were saying. That's funny.
Right. So they tried to manage her expectations about life, but she was just one of those, like, bullheaded, oh, I'm just going to be smarter than you. And then I'm going to move around this and I'm going to get there. People tried to tell her that she would never be an astronaut a lot. She was the youngest children of three. Being youngest has its advantages. She did a lot of ballet dance. She was a ballet dancer in her young life as well. She gets into NASA. She comes out to Los Angeles, California. Sally Ride. Sally Ride was her inspiration to go into the astronaut program. That's when she knew I could get there. She was the first group selected following the destruction of the Challenger, which is probably pretty breathtaking. She reapplied to be at NASA in 1987. She wasn't accepted at first in 1986. She tried again in 1987. And she was chosen out of 2,000 applicants to be one of the 15 people on the spaceship, on the shuttle. She flew her only space mission. She was up in space for from the 12th of the 20th of September in 1992. It was NASA's 50th shuttle mission. She logged 190 hours in space. She orbited the Earth 127 times. She brought with her up to space a poster from the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. She also brought with her to space a West African statuette.
Now our next guest.
And a photo of the pioneering aviator Bessie Coleman, the first African-American with an international pilot's license. So those were her three touchstones that she brought with her to space. What was she doing? Huh?
Sorry.
Okay. what was she studying up in space? They were doing biofeedback and autogenic training to help patients monitor and control the physiology for motion sickness, anxiety, and stress-related disorders. I guess they thought that space was a good, clean environment for all that study. So post-NASA, she was served on the board of the World Sickle Cell Foundation for a few years. She founded the Jemison Group, which is a consulting firm that considers socio-cultural impact of technological advancements and design.
Amazing.
She was also at the Colorado School of Mines. She has She has a little camp there that students age 12 to 16. I love her. I can't say enough about her. She is very much alive and kicking. And I think my favorite thing that she did after space exploration was go to Star Trek. She was in Star Trek.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Sorry. damn it. Hang on, because I got a picture of her in Star Trek somewhere in here, and I totally forgot to upload it. And I think I geeked out on it so much that I was just like, oh, my God, and then I left it. Here we go.
She's standing next to Jordan.
Yeah. That's cool.
And then, of course, Cap, you know, Uhura had to come and talk to her as well. Nichelle Nichols is from Colorado, I want to say. She's a Denverite. So Nichelle Nichols came out and came to set with her, and I'm sure they had an amazing long talk, because Nichelle Nichols is undeniably a reason a lot of Black women pursued professional trade. I mean, she may not want all that responsibility, but she was seriously responsible for so many women saying, I see her on TV, I can do it now. I'm going to try now.
I agree. And famously, Dr. King told her as much.
Oh, yeah, Dr. King says,
You stay there.
Yeah. But, I mean, Whoopi Goldberg credits her with everything. She says, I saw Michelle Nichols, and I decided to go for it. Yeah. So Mae Jemison probably had a lot of wonderful conversation with her, but she was on Star Trek, and I think that just blows my mind. She's still alive. She's only 63.
There you go.
But
isn't that almost the same age as Ruby Bridges?
I think it's 65 or 67.
Should give you an idea of just how she was part of that same generation, and the fact that she made out into space like that. What an incredible achievement, and what an incredible individual.
She got 3 degrees from arguably some pretty hard schools to get into. Degrees, but she just could not be stopped.
Yeah.
Wasn't going to take the color of her skin as a no. She wasn't going to do it.
Amazing. All right. We have come to the end of the whole thing. I do want to give us a chance for a little show and tell. And Christian, I know we're kind of blindsiding you with this, but I feel like your cup runneth over with show and tell.
Yeah, you might have to be our show and tell, because I don't have anything.
But while Christian figures out, and I don't know if you guys have anything planned, Dan, maybe you can just show us the banner that you showed us earlier as your show and tell. But I'm going to show my show and tell as you guys kind of panic and try to figure out what you're going to do. And this is video of me in front of the fireplace at the Explorers Club in New York. Private club, excellent bar, by the way. I think the bar at the Explorers Club might be my favorite place in the universe. I literally sat in a bar with, I assume, were explorers. Drinking insane drink, trying to come up with a name for a cocktail named after Admiral Cousteau. And and I got hammered before the event that I was supposed to cover, so I didn't do a great job on that. Apologies to the client that had to endure that. I ate crickets. And I ran up a tab. I still have I still have a lot of different stuff from that visit, but I also drunkenly did a reading of primate behavior in front of the fireplace in one of the rooms there at the Explorers Club. And the audio isn't great, but I just encourage you guys to pay attention while you find something for your show and tell.
Start. Go.
Kara and Carl slept late the next morning, as orangutans sometimes do, emerging from their nest about an hour after dawn. Kara urinated and then broke and dropped two small twigs, possibly in token of acknowledgement of my presence. She did not, however, vocalize.
Wow. She did not urinate, but she did vocalize. And I think I can say that's pretty indicative of my, oh my God, I lost everybody.
No, I just
went. No, I mean, Dan and John, both Brass and Christian also disappeared.
I just needed to go look.
I'm sorry. I thought the urination thing was kind of funny. I guess you guys all just like, that's cute, Alf. It's just you reading in front of a, okay, whatever, fine.
Hands back.
Okay.
That is an insane show and tell. Come on. We can't top that.
Really jealous, yeah.
We can't top that.
All right. So let's see some show and tell. Christian, what do you got as our guest?
It was the book that I started off with at the beginning, which is told at the Explorers Club. I stole this from the Oxnard Library, which is a Carnegie Library, and it is fantastic. 1931 copy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and each story in it. Each story in it is this miraculous thing that shows you that deep down inside of all this like hatred and conquest and showmanship, there are people who care and who get affected by the people that they're surrounded by the tribes, by the individuals, by the guides, the porters. And day by day, they start learning because of all, despite their best efforts to be superior. They learn about all these people, and back to your point, Brass, it's all about representation. And when people see themselves on screens, in pictures, in stories, and in books, they believe that they can do it too. So these are the stories that are told at the Explorers Club.
Cool. Awesome.
Love it.
What do you got, Brassy? Got anything for us today?
I snapped this up really quick. This belongs to my roommate, but it is a international bestseller, apparently, how to read Egyptian hieroglyphics. My dream is to go to Egypt and get into the king's tomb. I know that those tours are super expensive and you have to really have all your shit together before they let you in there, but I've talked to a few people who have been there, and it's like I'm saying it out loud so that something can come true. I think hieroglyphics was one of my very first obsessions as a child that was extracurricular. And then after that, I taught myself how to read and write in Dwarven or Tolkien. I'm one of those kids. I literally learned to read and write in Tolkien.
Literally talking to three people who – we're too lazy to do that.
Oh, well, I just mean, like, I...
We would have done it, but we're just like, I think we could watch some TV or something. I think it's...
It's how I pass notes to my boyfriend in high school.
Oh, wow. That is amazing.
I'm just saying. And I want to say that that boyfriend, he'll remain anonymous for reasons, but he is now a professor of linguistics. As well.
Wow.
Your own mountain jack.
Yeah.
And your mountain jack.
Yeah, no, he was not. Definitely not. He was a sane person.
As they would say in Elvin.
Right. The happened after college, but that's okay. What's everybody else's thing?
All right, I won't speak Elvin. I wasn't going to. I was going to say, anyway. All right, what do you got, Dan? What's your show and tell?
Okay, two things. One, I want to show what I'm drinking.
Oh, okay. You're frozen.
Oh, boy. You're going to need to dig yourself out of this Wi-Fi with frozen poop.
Oh, man. Oh, there it is. There it is. What is that?
Oh! I'm hollering at that.
That's amazing. Oh, I didn't even know that existed. What a weird Walter's Pueblo chili beer. I got diarrhea just looking at it.
Wow. My stomach is rumbling, but I want it so bad. It's so weird. I'm so into it. Oh God, I'm into that. And then what else? What do you said? Two things.
That's it. That's all we got from Dan. What else you got, Dan? Fantastic.
Okay. So you can't go exploring without a compass.
Without a what? Concubine? Oh.
And you can't do a broadcast without Wi-Fi.
Dan.
All right. All right. Well, that does it for our Explorers show. We're going to see everybody out with the story of Pretafruition and the poop knife in this animated version of that story. Dan's going to try and jump back in. All right, Dan, can you hear us, Dan? Can we see your compass?
All right.
Oh,
that's pretty.
The compass. Is this awesome?
It's
wow. 1917? That is really serious. That is a serious piece of equipment.
Wow.
Oh.
Good show.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Look, I've got a video. You've got this compass. Wow.
Jesus Christ, Dan. Yeah. That's cool.
Awesome.
God damn. This was a great topic, Alf. I'm serious.
It was a lot of fun. I think we learned a lot. A lot. Awesome, Dan. Thank you. And thank you,
Christian. Thank you for joining us.
Christian Lamont for helping us out with the whole idea of exploration. We're going to see you guys out with this animated feature about Pretafruition and his poop knife. Bye, everybody.
My family poops big. Maybe it's genetic. Yeah. Maybe it's our diet. But everyone births giant logs of crap. If anyone has laid a mega poop, you know that sometimes it won't flush. It lays across the hole in the bottom of the bowl, and the vortex of draining water merely gives it a spin as it mocks you. Growing up, this was a common enough occurrence that our family had a poop knife. It was a rusty old kitchen knife that hung on a nail in the laundry room, only to be used for that purpose.